You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to go back to examine what some have called the biggest American foreign policy disaster this century. That's the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. New information has become available that sheds more light on the factors that led to the invasion, especially among some of the key players in Iraq, including Saddam Hussein. That information forms a key part of a new book called The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. The author is Steve Collin. He's with me today as my guest. Steve is a Pulitzer Prize winner, two-time Pulitzer Prize winning author and journalist, former reporter at the Washington Post, and he's an editor at The Economist and also writes for The New Yorker. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, let's talk about this new information that came to light and your role in it to kind of set the stage here for what you found. But can you talk about that a little bit first?
Yeah, I've long been interested in why Saddam Hussein, the longtime president and dictator of Iraq, had created the impression that he had weapons of mass destruction when he had none. Of course, there were many reasons why the United States made the error of believing he did possess WMD, but there was Saddam's side of the story, and it never was really part of our self-examination after we found that he didn't have weapons. So years passed, and I learned that there might be a way to explore that question, because Saddam taped his leadership conversations more assiduously than Richard Nixon. And these tapes have a strange history, but the short version is that when I started working on this book, they were not publicly available. So I had to file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Pentagon, which possessed them, and ultimately got a good batch of them. And then through other investigative reporting techniques, got other parts of it. And so was able to reconstruct what Saddam was thinking through this long relationship he had with the United States before we invaded and overthrew him.
Well, as listeners will recall, we went through a long period here of Saddam, the Iran-Iraq war, the Kuwait invasion, and then events leading to the American invasion. But as I read your book, it just felt like a disaster coming that was totally preventable. And it's hard to read, really, because of the scale of human suffering. But I want to explore all these topics. But in short, why did Saddam not admit or come forward and say, I don't not have weapons to avoid this war?
Well, he felt as if he wouldn't get credit for the admission. And the reason he felt that is a bit complicated. But I think you mentioned the key turning points. So we have to remember that during the 1980s, we tried to build an alliance with Saddam Hussein. In fact, the CIA provided him secret satellite intelligence for years to help him avoid losing the war he had started with Iran during the 1980s. And all that time, he wondered if the U.S. was a sincere partner. In fact, he used to say to his generals, I think these pictures are probably doctored, or there's something wrong here. I don't trust the Americans. And his generals would say, well, look, boss, you're always right, but we can look at these pictures and we go around the mountain and the stuff that's on the pictures is there. So keep them coming. It's helping us. But he kept saying, look, something's wrong. And he said, if the photos are authentic, then the Americans are providing the same photos to the Iranians in order to bog us down in a stalemate. He turned out to be right about that, because the Iran-Contra scandal of 1986, which was announced in November of that year, revealed that the Reagan administration, in a somewhat harebrained effort but sincere effort to get hostages held by Iranian proxies released, had in fact provided weapons, intelligence, and other support to Ayatollah Khomeini, just as Saddam had been predicting privately to his aides. And the world was shocked that the Reagan administration had done this. The one world leader who was not surprised was Saddam Hussein. And we have this wonderful tape of him coming into the office the next morning after Reagan reveals all of this and says to his comrades, essentially, look, I told you so. I told you so. And the important thing about this is that he remembered this for many years afterwards. And when the Americans in the 90s kept telling him, look, disarm yourself, give up your dangerous chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and the missiles that could deliver them to faraway countries, he kept telling his comrades in private, we can now see, look, remember Iran-Contra. This is all a game. Even if I disarm, I'm never going to be given credit for that. What he wanted was sanctions relief, the normal reintegration of Iraq's economy with the world's economy. And he kept telling his diplomats who would urge him to do more, to cooperate more, to get rid of more things, to admit more about his secret past. And he would say, well, we can. I'm willing to give you a little bit of time to see if you can prove me wrong, but I promise you, we will never get credit for this. And finally, I just mentioned that in 1997, the Clinton administration confirmed his fears again when Madeleine Albright delivered a speech in which she said, regime change is now our policy. And even if Saddam admits everything, we will not give him sanctions relief until he's removed from power. Again, he came to his comrades and said, see, I told you so. This is all a game and you're fools for playing it.
That was the policy of three straight administrations, as you point out in the book as well, to regime change.
Yeah, it was striking going through the details to be reminded of how firmly the second term President Clinton had embraced a regime change.
The other big event, of course, was Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. And talk a little bit about that, what you learned through this new information about what led to that and whether it was preventable or not.
Yeah, it's a really important question, because when he invaded Kuwait and then triggered the Gulf War of 1991, in which President George H.W. Bush assembled a remarkable coalition of 40 nations to expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait, he set Iraq and the United States on the path to the 2003 invasion. And with the benefit of hindsight, we ask, you know, could we have avoided this war over Kuwait and the sharp deterioration in our relations with Saddam by essentially deterring him from invading Kuwait? That's a question, you know, that recurs around Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine in 2022, where we now know the Biden administration knew what he was planning to do, but felt helpless to stop him. In the case of the Bush administration and Saddam, they really didn't know what he was planning to do this. And so they failed to warn him that if he did, he would pay a very, very, very high price. Now, if they had warned him, would he have hesitated? I think there's evidence that he very well might have, because after he occupied Kuwait, before the war to expel him began, George H.W. Bush sent his Secretary of State, James Baker, to meet with Saddam's principal emissary, Tariq Aziz, to tell him, look, if you use chemical weapons in this war, we are going to set you back to the Stone Age, in so many words. If you fight a conventional war, you're going to lose. It's a foolish war to fight, but we're just going to fight the regular war. We're not even planning to overthrow you. We're going to knock you out of Kuwait. You're going to suffer miserably. It's a foolish thing to do, but it's just going to be a regular war. But I'm telling you, if you go chemical, it's going to be game changer. And Aziz brought that back to Saddam, and Saddam had deployed chemical weapons with the intent to use them against the Americans. And at the last minute, he changed his mind and he said, okay, don't use any of those weapons. So it shows that self-preservation, even for someone as aggressive and unpredictable as Saddam was, trumped everything else. And so we failed to deliver that kind of a warning to him in the first place to stop him from going into Kuwait. It's a complicated story, and I'll just be very brief and say one thing about it. You know, George H.W. Bush was probably our most qualified foreign policy president. I mean, he was really well prepared for the job. He did it well, for the most part, around, for example, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the reunification of Germany. He was quite adept at managing the Cold War's unpredicted end. But in this, he became trapped by his own good practices in a way, because he wasn't sure what to make of Saddam's threats to invade Kuwait. It was clear that he was assembling forces. He was barking mad about it. He was talking in public, issuing terrible threats. But every time George H.W. Bush picked up the phone and called allies in the Arab world who knew Saddam better than he did and said, "Hey, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, I'm worried. I'm feeling like this is not looking good." And Hosni Mubarak would say, "George, don't worry. This is all just a bluff. He's looking to threaten Kuwait in order to get paid. If you get involved, if you start taking this seriously, you're only make things worse. King Fahd in Saudi Arabia said the exact same thing. King Hussein in Jordan told Bush the same thing. In the end, you know, when Saddam invaded, Bush was said to his advisors, you know, everyone we asked was wrong, except the Israelis who told us he was going to do it. It was a missed opportunity with long-lasting consequences.
Before we get more into the American invasion, just if you could kind of briefly summarize Hussein. I mean, he did have weapons of mass destruction. He did use some of them on several occasions against his own people. But you might just track that up to when they were dismantled and eliminated throughout this period we've been discussing.
Yeah, well, we're at the right spot, because after the Kuwait war, when his forces were thrown out of Kuwait, the UN united with the Soviet Union cooperating and China cooperating, passed a resolution demanding that Saddam rid himself of all of his weapons of mass destruction. So his chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. We didn't understand that he had an advanced nuclear weapons program that was soon discovered. And he was also ordered to come clean about the history of these programs and dismantle any factories or dual use facilities, as well as missiles that had a certain range. So this was the force of international law, and the UN set up an inspection regime to come in and start to do this. They had the power of the Security Council behind them to tear down factories, to run around Iraq and look for things. Okay, so Saddam faced a choice. If he did not cooperate with this demand, he was going to be prohibited from selling oil on the world market. He was going to be subjected to all kinds of economic sanctions. His economy was already in ruins because of the foolish wars that he had started twice, once against Iran and the second against the United States. And if he wanted to dig himself out of this hole, he needed sanctions relief. So what should he do? Should he come clean with these inspectors or what? And he did something that, even in hindsight, is completely baffling. As the first inspectors were arriving, without telling his own generals what he was doing, he called his son-in-law in and said, "I want you to oversee the secret destruction of all of our WMD stocks and equipment, anything incriminating, just get rid of it." And his son-in-law dutifully did so with the help of secret police and others. They trucked chemical weapons into the desert and just dumped them in the sand. They tore down the nuclear weapons factories and tried to hide all of the component parts. They shredded documents. They tried to cover everything up. Did they keep any records of what they had done? Did they keep any photographs to prove that they had destroyed these things? No, they did not. This was all a completely improvisational effort. Now, why did Saddam disarm himself but not take credit for what he had done? The answer is in these tapes, and you have to listen to them for a while to finally get there. But what becomes clear is that he was kind of shrewd in his own way. By his logic, what he wanted to do was to pass these inspections without enduring the humiliation of having a bunch of guys in white coats publicly disarming him. He feared that if it was completely clear that he no longer had dangerous weapons, that his enemies in Iran or Israel might attack him, or that he might even encourage his own generals to stage a coup against him because he looked so weak. So he wanted to keep a certain amount of ambiguity, but he also wanted to pass the inspection. So he didn't want there to be anything to find when the inspectors turned up, because he figured that if he passed the inspections, maybe his allies in the Security Council, France and the Soviet Union, would figure out a way to get him out of sanctions, because they could say, hey, look, there's nothing there. He says he's done it. Apparently he's done it because they can't find anything. Well, what he actually did was create a decade's worth of confusion, because the inspectors turned up, they couldn't find anything, but they found hints that something had been there. And the Iraqis told all these crazy cover stories about what had been destroyed. And so this confusion and the fact that he kept lying while covering up the essential truth of his disarmament was never cleared up all the way until 2003.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm Robin Johnson, and my host today is Steve Call, who's written an outstanding book called The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. I've read another of Steve's books called The Ghost Wars. And if you were to ask me which one's better, I couldn't tell you. Read them both. They're both outstanding on America's overseas involvement after September 11th. The CIA is in your title, and they play an enormous role in this book. And of course, people will remember the CIA director, George Tenet, saying evidence of weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk, a basketball term. We all remember that. But the more I read in this book, the more I read now generally, the CIA needs it just isn't a very high performance agency, to be blunt. But Saddam saw the CIA differently.
Yeah, well, he thought that they were omniscient, basically, that they knew everything. And this was another factor in his refusal to cooperate with the United States and with the UN, because he believed that the CIA already knew what he had done, this confusing decision to dump everything into the sand without keeping records, because of course they know everything. And he said, well, they're accusing us of having WMD. The CIA knows very well that we don't have WMD. Therefore, these accusations are just a pretext. It's a game, another game that they're playing. And what is their purpose? The same one that's always been, which is to get rid of me. And I'm not going to cooperate in my own demise. So I'm not going to cooperate with their demands for more inspections or more information and such. And so he misattributed to the CIA powers of intelligence and knowledge that it didn't possess. So this is not unusual in the global South and in other parts of the world. Everyone, and the CIA does a great job at promoting its image of all-powerful, and all-powerful, all-seeing through Hollywood movies and television shows and that sort of thing. And, you know, if you're sitting in Baghdad watching satellite television for year after year and you've never even visited the United States, well, you might think that that's what the CIA is really like. You know, the CIA is more complicated than that. It does some things well and does other things poorly. From time to time, it does both at the same time. And in the case of Iraq, they were given really a terrible mission, which was to solve a problem that three presidents couldn't muster the political strategy or will to solve through whole of government means, as they would say in Washington, that is bringing to bear all of the influence that the United States had and just making this an absolute priority, getting it done. Instead, they turned to the CIA for covert action, the silver bullet strategy. And the history of the CIA's covert action programs from the 1950s, parachuting exiles behind the Iron Curtain to the Bay of Pigs, to the case of Iraq, is that if you use covert action as a substitute for foreign policy, you're asking for failure. And that's what they got here. They tried again and again to stage a coup against Saddam, which George H.W. Bush and then Bill Clinton even hoped might relieve them of the need to deal with this problem. But the book chronicles why that failed and how it failed, often tragically in human costs.
You talk about how this is shocking to me. There was no official contact for 13 years leading up to the U.S. invasion. I mean, there's other back channels, I know, and all this, but it's no wonder then that the just miscommunication, misreading of intentions and all this was seemed like a big factor leading up to the invasion.
Yeah, not really even back channels. And yeah, so I, you know, as I was finishing the book and as I've gone around to talk about it a little bit, naturally people say, well, what are the lessons of this for the United States? And I'm not a policy practitioner and nobody wants me to be president of the United States. It's a hard job. But looking at this one, I mean, it doesn't make sense not to talk to your enemies if you have the opportunity to do so. And yes, maybe as a journalist, I'm biased because we talk to everybody. We talk to, you know, killers and people in prison and people who we know to be unreliable because we know that contact is better than the absence of contact. There are always fragments of information. You have to take everybody with a grain of salt. You have to rigorously evaluate what people are telling you. You don't just talk and say, okay, now I understand this person entirely. But you're never going to get insight if you isolate yourself from the subject you're trying to penetrate, especially when that subject is hard to get at. And so why would you not have contact with a dictator like Saddam, who was anxious to have conversations because he wanted out of his box? He thought he could always get out of his box by just talking more. And he had a whole agenda that he thought the United States ought to be interested in outside of WMD, you know. They shared views about the threat of Islamist terrorism. And he was, you know, no fan of radical ayatollahs in Iran. We had a common enemy there. There were all kinds of subjects that he was open to having even back channel conversations about. But we refused. And the reason was we were hell-bent on using sanctions as a coercive tool. They didn't work in this case, as they often don't work, because they leak. But in order to enforce a global regime of sanctions, presidents decided that if they were seen talking to Saddam, they would just give reluctant participants in the sanctions regime in France or elsewhere an excuse to break out of the regime and to start violating sanctions. So they isolated Saddam in order to maintain unity in the sanctions regime. But as a result, they missed all kinds of opportunities to learn about him. And maybe we'll get to this, but my favorite one was that when you get to the years right before 2003, it turns out that Saddam was writing novels day in and day out. He wasn't preparing his military to defend against an invasion. He was busy trying to get the last pages of his fourth novel to the publisher. Now, if you'd been talking to him for a few years, he probably would have wanted you to know that he was a great novelist. And you might have paused and said, whoa, wait, maybe this is not the same guy that he was in 1990.
That was an interesting part. As this is going on, he's writing novels. This invasion had so many repercussions that are negative. And without casting any aspersions on our troops, I think, who performed well. This part of the world is just, you can trace a lot of the upheaval back to this war, I think.
Well, it was very costly for the United States, several thousand deaths, and I think, more than 15,000 wounded, including many severely. And then Iraq was shattered by the war that followed and the civil wars that ensued. And the region was destabilized. Iraq has fought its way back and it's held itself together barely. It is endowed with great oil wealth. And so that has allowed them to stitch some kind of politics together. But the big winner after the invasion, of course, was Iran, which continues to wield all sorts of influence, much of it malign, inside Iraq today. Saddam always warned, I'm your best bet to keep the Ayatollahs contained. You may not like everything about what I'm doing, but I'm willing to fight and I'm willing to stand up against Iran. And if you knock me out, you're just going to create a vacuum that they'll fill. And there were people around George H.W. Bush and others who understood that was a dilemma. They didn't want to invade and overthrow Saddam in 1991, precisely because they thought that they would create a vacuum that Iran would fill. And so when we did exactly that in 2003, the result was predictable, but it's remarkable. You know, it wasn't really part of our national debate about the war, that Iran was going to, that this was going to be an own goal in our effort to keep Iran contained in the Middle East.
We've just hit the highlights of the book here, and I've only have time for one more question for Steve Call. You know, Steve, you've written as much and followed this and reported on as much as anybody, one of the preeminent experts in our nation on the Middle East in this general region. When you listened to these tapes, was there anything that surprised you that thought, wow, I didn't know that or wasn't aware of that, or really in just a couple minutes, can you summarize what that might have been?
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly Saddam's personality. He was charismatic and funny. He was like Tony Soprano more than just a humorless, sort of thug. They say in that you shouldn't write biographies about people you don't like. Well, I only do that, unfortunately. But some of the people that I've written about, Osama bin Laden, is kind of dull, not very bright, hard to write about. Saddam, you can see that he wielded power in a very rough area for a long time because he was shrewd, really shrewd, and he could be quite sharp and funny with his comrades. He was also, capable of great confusion at the same time. But anyway, I was surprised at what a full person he was, and I could see then why he had been successful within his own terms for a long time.
Steve Call's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. Steve is the author of The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. What's the Achilles Trap?
Well, it was both the CIA and Saddam used the metaphor of Achilles and his vulnerable heel to explain why the other side was going to be defeated by them. And they were both wrong in their perception of the other's vulnerability.
Steve, thank you so much for being on today, and I look forward to what you write next. Your books are very readable and very important. This is a groundbreaking book for our country, and with lessons I hope that our leaders learn for today.
Thanks very much for having me, Robin. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.